people are allowed to, you know, brew their own beer at home if they're so inclined. If we're, you know, legalizing.
Hi, this is Chris Bolin from ADI Lumberyard, and you're listening to WGXC Acra Catskill Hudson.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kaya Weidman of Germantown, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support. Let's talk about all the good things, talk about
things that you make. We want to know what you think. WGXC invites listeners to share their ideas, input, feedback, praise, and critiques. Email feedback at wgxc.org or drop a note at our Hudson studio at 704 Columbia Street, second floor.
Hello, it's 7 p.m. on the second Thursday of the month here on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, Hudson, and that means it's time for another installment of Movies on the Radio. Movies on the Radio is a monthly simulcast accompanying the Filmont Media Project's outdoor film screening series, Sidewalk Cinema, at 100 Main Street in Filmont, New York. My name's Heath. And you're tuned in to our monthly radio showcase of the sounds of experimental cinema and experiments in sound from artists, filmmakers, and makers of all types in Columbia and Greene counties and across the world. Right now, the Sidewalk Cinema's projector is warming up to screen Radioactive City by Catskill-based filmmaker and photographer Richard Sandler. Radioactive City is a short, experimental, diaristic documentary shot on the streets of Los Angeles in the spring and summer of 2011 during the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Like the rest of Richard's film work, Radioactive City is an acutely observed and poetically sensitive portrait of a time and place where the catastrophic and the mundane collide, and where beauty and the apocalypse sit side by side. It's also a meditation on the way media, film and radio in particular, shape and are shaped by the human and natural environment. It really is a wonderful film. So maybe warm up some hot cocoa, make some popcorn, and come on down to 100 Main Street here in Filmont to the Sidewalk Cinema. And even if you're not able to make it out tonight, listen in on Radioactive City. I think it really holds its own as a dense and suggestive piece of radio collage. After that, Stick around for the second half of the show when we'll have a conversation with the filmmaker himself, Richard Sandler. Okay, so it is just about time for a movie on the radio, but first, two quick notes. One, an apologies for some of the sound quality issues during my interview with Richard. I'm still working on chasing some gremlins out of my Zoom connection, it appears. Second, if you are not able to make it out to the Sidewalk Cinema in person, but would still like to watch along with the film on your mobile device, check out the Filmop Media Project's Instagram. We will be throwing up a link there where you'll be able to stream Radioactive City along with the radio broadcast. That's Filmop with an F, Media Project, on Instagram. And now the only thing left to do is settle in to listen in to Radioactive City, a film by Richard Sandler, on the radio.
Following the explosion at the nuclear reactor in Fukushima, higher than usual radiation has been measured in Tokyo. The plant operator and the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency officials say the current blast was heard around the suppression pool. The equipment that coordinates the pressure in the reactor container recorded 10 minutes from 7:46 a.m. local time. The reduced pressure inside the reactor had closed, and they were trying to open it when the explosion occurred. That was about an hour and a half after the explosion. Experts say the usual radiation level in Tokai Village is 0.05 microsieverts. They say the level at noon
news
was 2
this hour focuses entirely on the catastrophic earthquake in Japan. The permission has been expanded to 29
measurements to the government at 8:15 a.m. as required by law. The Ibaraki Prefectural government says it detected 5.57 microsieverts of radiation in the air. That's about 100 times higher than usual. Higher than usual radiation has been also detected in the capital Tokyo. The Metropolitan government says its institute, Central Tokyo,
police in Miyagi Prefecture say the number of bodies found on several beaches in Oshika Peninsula in the eastern part of Miyagi sphere
than usual. Another facility in Tokyo says it's detected two radioactive substances, cesium and iodine, which were both produced by a nuclear reactor. The Tochigi Prefectural government says it measured 1.318 microsieverts. 10,000
bodies were discovered in the coastal town of Minami Sanmitu.
Of the nuclear power
in the town,
plant,
nearly all the buildings and houses were swept away
level.
By tsunamis.
The Chiba Prefectural government says it measured 0.074 microsieverts at 6 a.m. in Ichihara City, 218 kilometers from the nuclear power plant.
85 deaths have been confirmed.
The University of Tokyo professor Keiichi Nakagawa says the higher than usual radiation in Tokyo is thought to connected to the radiation leak from the nuclear power plant in Fukushima, but he added that the current level is very low and won't affect human health at all. Radioactive substances emitted from nuclear power plants contain iodine and rare gases. Here's what people can do to minimize the risk of radiation exposure. Windows and doors should be closed and air conditioners or other forms of ventilation turned off. When outdoors, people are advised to wear masks or cover their mouths and noses with wet towels or handkerchiefs to prevent inhalation of radioactive substances. Skin should be exposed as little as possible. Measures should also be taken to prevent internal exposure through inhalation and consumption of food. Accumulation of radioactive substances can have long-term health effects. When returning home from outdoors, change clothes and wash hands and faces. People should also avoid drinking tap and well water and eating food that has been left outdoors. Tokyo Electric Power Company says the Fukushima No. 2 plant had safely stopped all four of its reactors as of Tuesday. The No. 2 plant is 11 kilometers from the troubled No. 1 plant. There were problems with the reactor's cooling system after the devastating earthquake on Friday. After Tokyo Electric replaced the pump motors, the temperatures in the reactors have dropped below 100°C.
The provision of medicine for people who need them is being managed. Food supplies haven't reached the inland area yet. Self-defense force personnel have not yet arrived
in the region.
Their
relief activity is apparently prioritizing tsunami survivors.
Some evacuees at the gymnasium have begun to suffer health problems.
Fukushima number one plant.
Are mostly fruit,
Ekamoto reporters on Monday evening that worked the pump water into the reactor resumed.
Tokyo Electric Power Company is battling to cool a reactor to prevent another explosion at its nuclear power plant in quake-hit Fukushima Prefecture. The utility firm said on Monday afternoon that fuel rods are exposed at the number 2 reactor in Fukushima number 1 plant after the level of coolant water dropped. At around 6:20 p.m., the power company began pumping in seawater. What appears to be a nuclear hydrogen blast has occurred at a nuclear power plant in Fukushima for the pumping system. Possibly said the likelihood of large volumes of radioactive materials occurred at 11:01 a.m. on Monday. At the number 3 reactor, the Tokyo Electric Power Company says Fukushima number 1 into the reactor is working. The agency says it has so far observed no abnormal rise in radiation.
Japanese Foreign Ministry says rescuers from 11 countries and territories, South Korea, Singapore, Germany, Switzerland, China, the United States, New Zealand, Britain, Australia, Mexico, and Taiwan have already arrived in Japan. Rescue teams from France and Russia are on the way to Japan.
A similar hydrogen blast occurred at the number 1 reactor in the same plant on Saturday. Chief Japanese Secretary Yuki Edo told reporters that he has received a report that the latest blast
of the earthquake damaged the Fukushima number 1 plant. Edo told reporters on Monday.
Music from the Tron Legacy Reconfigured remixes of the soundtrack. This one courtesy of Moby, remixing Daft Punk, The Son of Flynn. So I don't know if you heard, but Daft Punk, they are auctioning off their vintage Ferrari in support of Japan. Yes. It's up on eBay. Through the UK. It's up to 15,000 pounds right now. 1987 Ferrari 412. Cool, right?
tonight with the many new developments surrounding last week's attack on Giants fan Brian Stowe, beaten and nearly killed at a Dodgers game last Thursday night. They did not have to remove the frontal lobe of Brian's brain. They did, though, as we said, temporarily remove a portion of his skull to relieve pressure.
Paparazzi today.
Oh, great.
How's everything out here today?
Oh, fine.
Yeah?
I'm looking for work.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, I used to be an investigator, but since my accidents, I can't drive anymore. I can barely walk anymore, but so I'm trying to get a job in a medical environment.
What happened to you?
Somebody hit me on four different occasions. This was my fourth accident. And I was, I have screws and pins in my leg and my arm.
Baby rapster, uh-huh. Small one there.
Tokyo Electric Power Company says that in the worst-case scenario, highly radioactive water may overflow from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant as early as June 20th. The company is set to start operating filters for highly radioactive water from June 15th. However, it warns that if the filtering does not go as planned, highly radioactive water may overflow from a tunnel at the number 2 reactor. TEPCO says that by May 31st, 105,100 tons of wastewater had accumulated. It contains an estimated 720,000 terabecquerels of radioactive substances. Tera stands for 1 trillion.
Hi, I'm Ali Tobia. I'm an actress. I've been in LA for 2.5 years. I appreciate very sexy roles and roles with a lot of feminine depth.
Think that everyone thinks it's just gonna be like Santa's playground. It's like Land of the Misfit Toys. Nah, this is really harsh, man. I've watched dreams succeed and I watched them fail. So would you come to LA for, man?
What was I talking about, LA? Yeah, gorgeousness. Yeah, so showing up at like the Grove or the Getty. Everything is boutique-y, or the Arclight Cinema on Sunset, the most expensive cinema in the world. It's in our neighborhood. It's on Vine, a little bit after Vine, on Sunset. And it's like $14 a movie, but there's artwork hanging in the hallways and, you know, nice carpeting everywhere. Gorgeousness. That's all about. That's the game. Get in on it. Tap some of that gorgeousness. Your own riff, some of those notes.
operator of the Fouque plant said Friday more radioactive water could begin spilling into the sea later this month if there's a glitch in setting up a new decontamination system. Tokyo Electric Power also said two workers may have been exposed to radiation at more than twice the limit set by the government, the most serious case so far of exposure among hundreds of workers at the Fouque plant. Nearly 110,000 tons of highly radioactive water, enough to fill about 40 Olympic-sized swimming pools, are stored at the plant. Tokyo Electric has pumped massive amounts of water to cool three reactors where meltdowns occurred. Managing the growing pools of radioactive water is a major challenge with the start of Japan's rainy season. The plant is running out of storage space. By sealing relevant areas, we plan to prevent contaminated water from leaking into the sea, said TEPCO. Radioactive soil in pockets of areas near the Fouque plant have reached the same level as Chernobyl, where a dead zone remains 25 years on. Radiation from the plant has spread over 230 square miles, according to the report. The extent of contamination shows the government must move fast to avoid the same future for the area around the Fouque plant as Chernobyl.
Am I in your way? I'm in your way. Party pooper. What kind of Dodger fan are you?
Radioactive City is the name of the piece, and it is a documentary, a personal, one-person documentary made by me in Los Angeles from January of 2011 until July of 2011. And it is a hybrid of three-chip mini DV video and Super 8 film and 16 millimeter film, and also sound that I recorded for it specifically on a really good recorder with a great mic, a great external mic, you know. So the only sync sound is the video. But as I said, I recorded quite a bit of sound, purely for sound, and to use the sound as a kind of painting, a sound painting, if you will, that would be put in here and there to, you know, deliberately reinforce the direction of the piece. So it was, at the same time, it was also like the first time I ever really did a solo sound piece. And so it was fun to paint with sound.
So let's come back to the sound, because among many other things, I think Radioactive City is a film about radio, which of course makes it a great film for us to look at here on Movies on the Radio. But you mentioned the three different sort of filming formats or visual image media you used. You used a hybrid of digital video and analog film formats, Super 8 and 16. And each of those have a different look. And I wonder if you could take a stab at describing, you know, those different looks, those different feels, and maybe talk about what led you to use different formats for different subjects in the film.
Okay. I've had a bit of experience with using these formats at the same time in the same project, that is, on a long form doc that I'm working on called AKA Martha's Vineyard. And that one is, that's where I started in doing that, I'm making a film, mostly film, although there's a chapter in video, that employs Super 8, 16, 35 millimeter film and digital video, all four of those formats. And so I had given a lot of thought already to what format went with what subject matter. So generally, the shooting of nature in Los Angeles, I shot on Super 8, primarily Super 8. And it was way more Super 8 than 16. So I don't really want to talk too much about the 16, except I did use it in a few shots. And for the uninitiated, they're not really going to be able to tell maybe the difference between the 16 and the Super 8. Because the Super 8 camera that I have is really sharp, and it already looks like 16 millimeter.
Fantastic! Yeah, it's some of the crispest, cleanest Super 8 film work I've seen.
Oh, I've put a lot of time into shooting Super 8. I've become, you know, kind of a nerd, a Super 8 junkie / nerd.
And let's clear it out for a minute. What Super 8 camera are you shooting on, or cameras?
That's the right question. Well, my main axe has always been the Canon 1014 XLS. Originally, it was a sound camera, but they don't make sound film for Super 8 anymore. But it's still the best of the American cameras, pretty much. And then I also have a Beaulieu 8008, which is a terrific camera with a very, very, very sharp lens. Even sharper than the Canon. And then the pièce de résistance is the Lysina, which was the Super 8 camera made by Leica, by Lights and Company, for about 4 years or 5 years from, I think it was from 69 through 74. So that camera, unfortunately, it's broken now, but that camera is really sharp. And it has a so-called M mount on it, which is the same mount that Leica still 35 millimeter still cameras have. So I'm able to use my 35 millimeter still camera lenses on that camera, and it quadruples the focal length.
Wow.
So a 90 becomes a 360.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So I took advantage of that camera. So anyway, those are the ones that I used, and that's the reason why was because I was looking not for that, you know, crappy looking kind of plastic lens-ish look, mm-hmm. of out of focus, you know, jumpy Super 8. I was looking for a really clean, really grainy, very sharp. All the color in the movie that I'm talking about, AKA, is shot on Kodachrome before Kodachrome ended, of course, and before the developing of Kodachrome ended. And so it looks just extraordinary.
And yeah, one of the things I really appreciate about the way you use analog film, especially in your Martha's Vineyard films, which unfortunately we're not screening today, is the way that you use the sort of ephemeral quality you get from film, especially the Kodachrome, you know, this dying, not, you know, now obsolete film stock to capture the ephemeral in the landscapes you're exploring. So whether it's the you know, the indigenous peoples who your films are always sensitive to their presence or their absence in some cases, or whether it's just the kind of ephemeral colors and moods of nature. You know, you do a lot of film of the fall and of sort of autumn colors and textures, which of course really pop and have those reds and those deep saturated gem-like colors that you get only with certain kinds of color film stocks, and you really make the most of that. But I don't want to, you know, let's not geek out too long on the Super 8, because I do want to dig into Radioactive City itself. I think you've described it either in writing or with me on other occasions as a sort of diaristic film, right? And it is about Los Angeles. I think it's about the radio. I think it's about the environment in a lot of really interesting ways, whether that's the natural environment or the built environment. It's also about the sort of media environment and the way our media interacts with the way we experience our environment. And I wonder if you could talk more about that, specifically about how you use the radio to conjure what it was like for you personally in Los Angeles. How does the radio and the sounds we've just enjoyed contribute to the landscape of the diary entry you're making here about this time and place?
In Los Angeles, you do a lot of driving, of course. And in driving, you listen to the radio. So I would be listening to the radio on my way to go shoot something, whether it was in the mountains or in the valley or the built environment or nature, whatever it was. You know, usually it involves a half hour to an hour of driving. And since the film was about these two terrible events that happened within 2 weeks of each other, the first being the tsunami and meltdown of the nuclear power plants in Fukushima, and also the beating into a coma of a Giants fan at Dodger Stadium on opening day of 2011. He got beat up into a coma for being a Giants fan by, you know, some local thugs. Mm-hmm. And that really had me spooked. It had LA spooked. There was a radioactive cloud, a measurable radioactive cloud that, you know, eventually got to Los Angeles 3 or 4 days later. There was even a tsunami, small though it was, but did a lot of damage, particularly north of Los Angeles and Santa Barbara Harbor. Most boats were destroyed, or many, if not most. So LA was pretty, I mean, LA is a town that's used to, you know, apocalypse. And, but this was a little bit much. The beating of this man, this terrible senseless beating, and also Fukushima. But of course that went on for days. And it took a while for radioactivity levels to come back down to, you know, base level. So there was definitely an exposure there. So that freaked people out. But like I say, LA is a town that's used to being, you know, that's used to apocalypse. It's used to being blown up. It's certainly been portrayed in the movies every which way to Sunday, you know, earthquakes and attacks from Mars or whatever. You know, they're always blowing up LA. And so, you know, driving around in that apocalyptic kind of environment at that time with the radio on, I'm always listening for news broadcasts, particularly about Fukushima and particularly about this man, Brian Stowe is his name. You know, listening for how he's doing and being alert to that and recording that in the car, either on my video camera, recordings just simply sound on the video camera of the radio, or sometimes I would bring I have a really good mic, you know, really good stereo and mono mic at the same time, or at separate times, but you can use the same mic for stereo or mono. And Yeah, just record as much as I possibly could. So I was recording sound everywhere I went, particularly on the radio. And that was a big part of it. Because, like I say, we live on the radio in Los Angeles if we're in the car.
Great, great. So already there we see how the sort of built environment and the media environment of Los Angeles are sort of shaping each other and shaping your experience of it. And I love this concept of Los Angeles as, you know, an apocalyptic city. You even capture, and of course you're right, you know, LA is sort of a sort of factory town for dreams. And a lot of those dreams are, you know, apocalyptic ones. You even capture, what was the film you get a billboard for? It was a totally forgettable film.
Yeah, it was. And the interesting thing, the film was, we should look at it or you could insert it later. I forget the name of it. But the date that it came out was March 11th. I mean, the billboard was saying that this was before March 11th. I taped this billboard, and March 11th is the day that Fukushima happened. It was 3/11. Mm-hmm. So it was some kind of, it might have even had Armageddon in it. I forget what it was, but it was
Battlefield LA. Does that sound right?
Battlefield LA, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Battlefield something. It might have been LA. I'm not sure, but it was yet another movie. If you watch, you know, Tom Anderson's Los Angeles Plays Itself. Did you ever see that one? In Los Angeles Plays Itself, this idea of LA being a town used to apocalypse is not my idea. It's more like his idea. But of course, he made this, you know, brilliant masterpiece of a movie, a documentary film about, you know, about how Los Angeles sees itself, how Los Angeles plays itself, shall we say, sees itself in the movies.
Yeah, one of the things I think you contribute to this conversation about LA as a city of apocalypse is a distinction between the sort of spectacular way that Hollywood likes to imagine apocalypse. You know, it's always aliens blowing up skyscrapers and, you know, hell and brimstone and all of that stuff. But you're in the midst of a real sort of, if not apocalypse, at least catastrophe. But in the real world, it's a silent, invisible one. You know, you are monitoring the radio to get reports on, you know, this invisible cloud of radioactivity. And maybe you can talk a little bit about some of your editing decisions, but one of the things I really like about your film is the way it is drawn back and forth between the sort of beauty, or at least the spectacle of LA, and then this invisible menace. And I wonder how much you are kind of trying to explore that terrain between the visible and the invisible in some of your editing choices.
Yeah, well, I'm exploiting it, actually. I'm you know, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's not 100% serious. This is not a serious documentary. It's, you know, that has a kind of didactic approach. It's very much a tone poem to Los Angeles, and I'm picking up on what essentially are first impressions. And I love these kinds of films where you go to a place that you know nothing about and you spend 6 months making a film about it because you have so-called beginner's mind, you know, that sort of Zen state where you see things in an unfiltered way, or hear things in this case as well in an unfiltered way. And you know, like Robert Frank, a Swiss man coming to the United States, making the book The Americans, you know, having only maybe been to the United States one time before and never having driven, you know, 25,000 miles around the United States to make a snapshot of America that was, you know, to from some points of view, very unflattering, but obviously a masterpiece, one of the masterpieces of 20th century art. But you know, I was very much jumped on that opportunity to see things fresh and to respond to them intuitively. I didn't have to make money. I had money in my pocket. And I did not go there to make a film, a documentary film. I only went there because I went there to edit a film with my editor who lives there. But unfortunately, he couldn't do it once I got there because he got thrown a big job to make a documentary about a famous person. And, you know, he had a wife and two kids, and he had to say, sorry, you know, we'll have to postpone this. So it wasn't that I didn't plan to make it. So that's another good thing about it, that it was not a plan. It had no forethought whatsoever. I said, well, I'll just do what I always do wherever I am, which is to make documentaries on film and video. So that's just my daily MO. That's not anything that I have certainly planned pieces, but I love it when documentaries make themselves, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm just following my own interest and, you know, just snooping around and finding stuff and realizing that you can, and also realizing that, you know, once you have a good idea, you can kind of make anything work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the sound that I recorded was recorded, you know, once I got going, I kind of knew more what I needed to fill with and background sounds. For instance, when you hear in the beginning of the piece, you hear this kind of electronic music. You know, it's unsettling. It's and what that is sound that I recorded at the Billy Wilder Theater in Los Angeles, which is a really cool place to, you know, it's Los Angeles is, you know, great, one of the great art houses. It is a UCLA theater. I took my video camera into the screening and started recording sound off some of the films that they were showing at the time, which in this case was TV commercials from the 60s. But I looped it and played it backwards, so it makes it even crazier. So I was, you know, I was really wigging out with sound. You know, I was really trying, you know, to how do you create a feeling of tension and dis-ease sound sonically? You know, we've already told people that it's a flick about the Fukushima event, and it's a flick about a guy getting beat up in a horrible way. And how LA is kind of is very nervous, and so you know that became clear that I had to do something like that to create that sonic feeling, so that you would feel uncomfortable as you were watching this, and you know use it in a kind of a subliminal way, which of course is how sound is, you know, very often used in film. But this was like pretty prominent, I think. You know, it really kind of grabbed you, I think. Mm-hmm. Although there are times when it was soft as well. So, you know, as I look back on it, I wish I'd made it an hour. Well,
something I really admire about your films, in addition to the way you're able to capture these landscapes, is your willingness to engage with human subjects on the street level, the people you sort of encounter as you go, you know, cinematically adventuring through LA or through New York. I know another of your films, The Gods of Times Square, is predominantly this, you spending time in Times Square and talking to people about all varieties of their sort of eccentric forms of religious or spiritual expression. So you talk to Buddhists and Scientologists and fundamentalist Christian evangelicals and, I don't know, Jews for Jesus and all sorts of people. Which myself as a shy person, I really admire and respect. I don't know if I'd be able to just spend as much time encountering people on the streets in the way that you do. But you do make time for those kinds of human encounters in your film about Los Angeles as well. And I wonder, the voices we hear included, I wonder if you could tell a little bit about how you encountered people as you spent time making this film and whose voices you chose to include and why.
Well, LA is, it's not a street, you know, it's not a street town like New York. It's a street town. Everybody's on the street. The street is everybody's living room on some level, you know. People hang out and they want to interact but in LA, you know, there's very few people on the street except downtown. I wasn't there all that much, but I was there. But, LA is not so much a town about talking. It's more of a town about showing, I think. And, you know, the dichotomy between the beauty of the built environment. That is the you know, the nature there is a built environment. It's not, it didn't look like that in 90. If you look at pictures of, you know, like Silver Lake in LA in 1900, it's just a desert. It's just rocks and a desert. And it's just a continuation of the San Gabriel, you know, hills and mountains around it. It doesn't look like anything. There's nothing.
Right? No, but before the water was there, it was.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, Chinatown. You know, it was just an ugly place. And so the beauty that's in the beautiful places in LA, like Brentwood and the Hollywood Hills and stuff, that's all man-made. That's totally a man-made fabrication. So I wanted to show that in a hyper-beautiful way. And I wanted to contrast that as well with, you know, the more mundane and boring parts of Los Angeles. But when it comes to people, you don't see them that frequently on the street. And also people don't want to talk. They're walking around in their bubbles very much. But I did burst at, you know, those bubbles.
I really liked the sort of highs and lows you were still able to manage to capture in your human interactions. There's one very short moment in the film where I don't know if you were only intending to, you know, get a shot of a street corner or something, but I don't know if it's like a Bentley convertible or something with some slick Hollywood producer types drive by. They just kind of shout to you, what are you making a doc? You know, the kind of do an industry talk. So you get the sort of, you see the winners of the Hollywood world, and then you talk to another gentleman who you know, tells you, you know, LA will smoke you, you know, and you get here, next thing you know, you're doing porn. And you really get a sort of cross-section of individuals at different places in their interactions with Hollywood. And I thought that was another really nice touch.
Human conversation is minimal in Los Angeles, but that isn't to say it's not profound. It can be very profound. About recording sound, it's a wonderfully easily made experiment that one can do on a daily basis, just to walk around and record sound. And I got into sound because I'm a child of radio first. My first medium is radio, not television. I'm older than television. So, and my mother was, as I had told you previously, I think she was a radio actress. And my godfather, who raised me as much as my father, was a producer. He was the first producer of Superman on radio. And wrote the words, "Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive." Alan Duchovny is his name for people out there that know about these things and will know him. So radio was my thing. You know, I grew up imagining pictures from sound, making pictures out of sound. And then in 1994, I worked with a fellow who became one of my dearest friends, David Isay, who started Sound Portraits Productions and then StoryCorps. So David, when he first heard the tapes from, or looked at the tapes, I should say, of The Gods of Times Square from my early, the beginning of taping in Times Square in 92, he said that would make a great radio piece. So in the tapes that I shot in Times Square from 1992 to 1994, I continued on until 98, but in the period of 92 to 94, David and I listened and looked at my videotapes with just an ear. The sound, the picture was not important. And together we made a radio piece that was aired on NPR on All Things Considered in 1994 on Friday, December 23rd, 1994 at 5:00 p.m. And it was a pretty kind of risque thing and chancy thing, even for NPR, which is pretty conservative, to put on. I encourage people to search that out. It's also called The Gods of Times Square. But anyway, all that to say, I love sound. It's really, like I say, my first medium, and I just want to do more of it. I'm looking forward to this next film that I'm editing now, aka Martha's Vineyard, and it will also be a very complicated sound tableau, you know.
I'm looking forward to it. And Richard, if people wanted to see any of your work that you do have online, where would they go to check that out?
Well, you can go to a Vimeo page under my name, Richard Sandler. There's a Vimeo page. So that would be the easiest way. And also there are things on my website, which is richardsandler.com. Mm-hmm. And the only other final thing I want to say about sound is that I learned a lot about sound by working with Dan Brown, who is the editor of The Gods of Times Square. And he's a terrific musician as well as an incredible film and video sound editor. So I was really fortunate. I stepped into a very well-worked fellow's mind about sound and how it can be used. Daniel Brown.
Wonderful. Richard Sandler, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. We really enjoyed talking with our guest, Richard Sandler, and screening his wonderful film, Radioactive City. Hope to have Richard back on the show again in the near future. Movies on the Radio airs the second Thursday evening of each month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7, Radio for Open Ears. We will be back on March 11th with more sounds and sights from the sidewalk cinema and from the world of experimental film and moving image art. You can check us out online at filmontmediaproject.org, that's Filmont with an F. Or find the Filmont Media Project on Facebook or on Instagram to stay updated with our Media Lab's projects, programs, and workshops. If you've got any comments or questions, or maybe you are a moving image maker based in the Hudson Valley and would like to share your work, you can contact us at filmontmediaproject@gmail.com. Movies on the Radio and the Sidewalk Cinema are productions of the Filmont Media Project and are both made possible in part with funds from the Decentralization Program, a re-grant program of the New York State Council on the Arts with the support of Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, administered in Columbia County by CREATE. Tonight's events were broadcast live on Wavefarms WGXC 90.7 FM in New York's Upper Hudson Valley, made possible by Wavefarms Transmit Partner Program. Tune in online at wavefarm.org to listen on the Wavefarm radio app. Filmont Media Project is a proud member of the Purpose Cooperative Makerspace in Filmont, New York.